Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time to get started. Welcome to the elephants in the room discussion. And if you're an elephant who doesn't want to be in this room, then leave quickly because the doors are about to close. It's my pleasure to introduce Jan and Andrea. They're both actuaries from Aon. Andrea will be talking first. Andrea is a principal. She's responsible for group risk benefits. Her primary role is to provide strategic, tailored solutions for employers and superannuation funds. Her experience enables her to deliver benefit, insurance and financial outcomes for organisations and superannuation funds. I'll introduce Jan now so that you can move smoothly on. Jan has 9 years' experience across life insurance, superannuation and investment. Her primary role is to provide strategic advice and tailored solutions. You can tell they work for the same organisation, can't you? Across the Asia Pacific, in relation to structuring and designing optimal risk transfer solutions. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and we've just had, for those of you who've remained in the room, we've just heard quite a lot already about this topic, but Jan and I hope to introduce a few additional thoughts for you. So this topic was basically chosen because we were seeing claims experience was poor and much worse than expected. We're seeing enormous losses being made by both insurers and reinsurers. We're seeing a whole range of different issues converging to cause the current situation that we're in. The presentation that we'll give, you'll notice, focuses a lot on TPD because that is where there are considerable issues. But it is also relevant to group salary continuance and to some extent to death insurance. So we will basically cover the issues from the angle of an insurance consultant and broker working with both insurers and reinsurers and also with superannuation funds and employer clients. And what we will actually do is we'll start just by setting the scene, what is the current position, and then we'll move on to some of the solutions that we see. So what we are seeing is many claims for lives who normally would be uninsurable. We've seen increases in premium rates by over 100% for some group clients when they reach the end of their 3-year rate guarantee period. We're also having experiences of no insurers being willing to quote for group risks on the current terms. And in addition to that, we've seen very high levels of automatic cover. So does this sound familiar? We're basically at a point where there is a shortage of available insurance cover. So very much the credit crunch of group insurance. So all of this is impacting a number of stakeholders in the insurance industry. As I mentioned, both insurers and reinsurers have publicly stated the losses that they've made in this area. We see trustees who are trying to do the best for their members, and we have the people who are paying the premiums, i.e. employers and members, not just now, but in the future, increasing. Something that definitely needs to be addressed. So the data that you see here is just for industry funds, and some of you will have seen something similar. The reason that we've focused on industry funds is because the data is very easy to find publicly. We've seen similar increases with corporate insurances, although not necessarily to the same extent. So these increases are for the period from the 1st of December. They're just a sample of funds. Those A2E were increases earlier in that period, so definitely something that we're seeing worsening. Despite this, in Aon's experience, particularly for employer groups, the premiums aren't always increasing. So it's a very mixed bag of results. So sometimes we see slight reductions in premiums, other times increases of over 100%. And as mentioned before, premiums are paid by employers or individuals. The data that you see on the screen is from a survey that Aon Hewitt carried out of large employer groups, medium to large employer groups, which basically shows that for debt and TPD premiums, there was an even split of premiums by employers and members, and for salary continuance, three quarters of the premiums were paid by employers. So whilst there's been a lot of focus on superannuation funds and the increasing costs for members, this is something that's impacting employers who have a very big interest in these issues. So where have we been? We thought that the past was a good indicator of the future. However, MySuper has changed the landscape. The competition between insurers for this rapidly increasing new business has greatly impacted the situation we're in. We've seen a change in the types of claims, clearly a huge increase in claims from lifestyle-related illnesses. There's now much easier access to information. People becoming more aware of the cover that they have. We've got advisors in some cases steering individuals to cover that they can easily obtain with little medical underwriting. And we've seen lawyers making members aware of cover and their potential to claim that they may have been unaware of in the past. So the reality that we're now living in was not expected, and it was certainly not modelled. From a broker's point of view, we're seeing insurers now pricing in uncertainty, and this seems to be to a large extent. We're seeing shorter rate guarantee periods. In summary, we've been caught out by the speed of change, and actuaries need to adapt quicker. So that's the picture as we see it. What we'd now like to do is to look at five of the biggest issues, which, as you might have guessed, we are matching one of them to each of the big five game animals. And we'll give you a few of our thoughts on how we can resolve these. So our first big game animal is the buffalo. And buffaloes travel in herds. They follow the leader. And so do insurers sometimes. In some cases, there's good reason for this. There's legislative requirements, and of course there's the competition as well. And we've certainly seen over the last five or more years, most of the focus on purchasing group life insurance has been on the price. One of the things that we believe can be changed is to give more thought to the disability definition. So thinking about TPD, is it reasonable that a TPD claimant shouldn't have to carry out any retraining to be able to make a claim? If you think about it, an individual who is well and continues to be able to work will continue learning and re-educating as they go through life. I would suggest that the definition that we have in most cases for TPD is far too generous. Looking at salary continuance, we're seeing more long-term benefits where we have an own occupation definition all the way through to retirement, and this is quite different than many other countries around the world which aren't experiencing the same increases in claims that Australia is. So I suggest move away from the herd, become more creative as insurers. So the second issue has been allocated to the lion. And as already mentioned, I believe that many of the terms in group insurance are overly generous. So we have high automatic acceptance limits, which means that people without any evidence of health are obtaining very large sums insured, particularly dangerous when those people claim. It's very easy to obtain cover without providing any medical evidence. And so maybe we need to find ways to get that evidence that somebody is in good health, that they really are able to work and haven't just turned up at their employer for one day before obtaining these high levels of cover. We can look to benefits that are provided overseas. There's much less focus on the lump sum. And as we saw and heard this morning, lump sums aren't generally what people are used to dealing with. People are used to getting incomes, and we might not be doing the right thing by the claimants by dangling a huge lump in front of them. It's a big incentive to claim. Why not give people an incentive to get better? Put a bigger focus on income benefits rather than that lump sum. We've certainly seen that there's evidence that people need to work, and it's worthwhile for people. Obviously, it's not for every claimant, but where possibly, let's have the focus on getting people back to work. But I'll now pass over to Jan to talk about the last three game animals.
Is this working? Okay. So normally, if you know me, normally the issue is turning me down rather than turning me up. So if I'm too loud, please somebody yell out. So before I start, a couple of things. We've got nothing against these cute African animals, except for the one here who's biting the other one. So otherwise, we've got nothing against these animals. Secondly, I feel really privileged to be here today. Many of you I've worked with and worked for, and I've learned a lot from. So thank you very much, Paul, in particular, for providing the introductions. He's taught me a lot of things, and some of the stuff you don't like about what I'm about to say, it's his fault. I'm going to just jump to the next door that we want to potentially close or shut. This is something that, you know, I think being debated a little bit in the industry, probably not as hotly debated, you know, like the TPD definition and reducing the benefits. This is more of a less low-hanging fruit, but I think it's going to be effective in, you know, changing the environment going forward. So this idea of the sunset clause, And it could be in a trust deed. That's one possible suggestion, not really the advice here. So we're not providing advice here, but it's a potential suggestion. So what is a sunset clause? Sunset clause is something that you could potentially put in a trust deed, for example, that will limit the maximum amount of period where a claim can be notified in relation to a claim event. So in other words, a member will need to report the claim to its fund within X amount of years from date of accident and or date of disablement. There's been a little bit of confusion around some of the chats about the statute of limitation that exists state by state. 9 years, 6 years, that's been discussed around the words of specialty. So again, I'm not a lawyer, but the conversation's been that this thing does exist in some form or the other. But that statute of limitation, state by state, differed. It's to do with from the date when it's notified. And the one here that we're talking about, it's from the date of original disablement and or accident. So subtle difference. So if we look at what this thing could look like in terms of the triangle, so what the sunset clause is trying to do there, it's to encourage early reporting. So if a member is disabled, they must, once the sunset clause come in, report within X amount of years. Otherwise, they are potentially not eligible for payout. I keep using the word potentially because ultimately, even if there is a sunset clause, I'm sure a life insurer or potentially a trust deed can use a little bit of discretion. But that being said, we think the effects, so for example here, if we limit the reporting period to 5 years from original date of accident or date of disablement, it's going to cut the tail. And if you've done pricing or spent a lot of time with triangles, that's a good thing for your pricing. Potentially, what it'll do is it'll limit that tail aspect of the late reporting, and it's going to reduce the uncertainty going forward as well. So, for example, if the smart insurer that was pricing years ago, they might have not seen the late reporting that's happened over the last year or so. They would have potentially priced in a more optimistic premium rate. Now, going forward, a reinsurer looking at this, while a lot of the catch-up claims have come through, they'll still have a question. So when would it end? When would it stop? And that uncertainty compounds itself as well. So by closing the door to that uncertainty, that tail element, we can potentially reduce the margins for that tail uncertainty for pricing going forward and can potentially save up to something upwards of 30%. Now, that 30% is really, a little bit like that because some funds may not have adequate data to go back that far. Some funds have probably had benefit changes and things like that going forward. So, but that being said, certainly some of the cases we've seen, it could have a potential to reduce premium up to that amount. Your initial reaction might be that's not a good thing. We don't want to deny an Aussie who's just reported a claim late. We don't want to deny them that. If it's a legitimate claim, we definitely don't want to deny them that. But I think there's some positive qualitative reasoning coming out of this that might support this sunset clause going forward. Once the sunset clause comes in, it's going to encourage that early reporting. So members will go, oh, wow, I've got to report within 5 years. So, okay, my trustees told me, they've sent me a lovely letter, my employers told me that there's this sunset clause. So I'm going to report earlier. As soon as I don't feel very well, I'm going to report that to somebody. So that would in turn encourage some of that early intervention that's happening in the market. So if they report earlier, then the fund or the company, HR, can get to them earlier to give them that help that they need. So I think there's some positives coming out of this as well. And we're not talking about a sunset clause of a year or two. We're saying a reasonable amount of time. And potentially 5 years might be reasonable. But happy to be debated, you know, once we get to the questions section. Yeah. So, the speed of response. Not sure what animal that is. I think that's a really fast animal. So the other door, arguably, I think it's been closed. It's around awareness. So the door around the low awareness of an average member to the fact that they've got cover, that's closed. That's a good thing. You know, it's closed somewhat to the member education and communications, but it's also closed due to some of the lawyer involvement over the last year or so. Now, we can say a lot of bad things about lawyers, but I think they've done a good thing here, potentially. Again, happy to be debated later on in the question section, but I think what they've done is, you know, raise that awareness to cover, and I think that's a good thing. You know, if somebody is, you know, have a genuine case of claim, they should be paid. It's a legitimate claim. Now, the problem here is it should have been, you know, perhaps it should have been done by the trustees, should have been done by maybe the HR department, you know, should have been done via member communication, should have been done by somebody else, other than the lawyers who's taking a big chunk of the benefits. And that's the bad thing. And we need to consider closing the door to that part. So awareness is good. It's just let's let the trustee or let's let the fund or let's let the insurance company do that work and not, you know, they should be the first point of call, not the lawyers. And so what's happening here? So the speed of that response or the increased awareness, that's meant, oh, we're coming back to the triangle again. You can see we're really enjoying the triangles. Everybody are actuaries here, so thought we have another go at the triangles. This thing works. So what's happening here is you can see in 2007, the claim year, 7 years later, it's reached an amount of $299. So this is an example rebased to $100 in the first reporting year. It's a typical industry fund that I've sort of based this off. So what's happening now is during the years of pricing here, you've got late claims that's coming through over this period. So that's meant the final bill, instead of to be about $256, it's $299. So had you priced it on $256 or $233, that's where you might have made some losses or strengthening in reserves. But if we look at 2010, the claim event year. By now, 236 is already reported. Now, what's that saying? Is that saying that by the end of another three more years, would that amount be something like 400? No, if you just keep completing that triangle. Or is 296 about right? You know, has the lawyers kind of found enough of these, you know, past legitimate claims to say that 296 is about right? And should you be pricing now at, the 400, or should you be pricing closer to the 296? And that's a big debate in the market when we're looking at pricing. And I'm happy to open the floor up later on and we can have a discussion around that. Maybe the right answer is somewhere in the middle. And I think part of that, again, is due to the raising awareness. In theory, if a reinsurer is on risk or an insurer is on risk, you know, for the next claim year, 2014, or current claim year, for example, will claims still come through 7 years later? You know, I mean, haven't we closed the door to awareness? So, you know, just coming back again to sort of everything that Andrea's, you know, introduced around, definitions need to potentially change and benefit designs need to change, and then coming back to all the other stuff around sunset clauses and playing with triangles. But I think the key is if we do nothing, the ultimate door to shut here is low pricing, so prices will have to go up. You know, the pricing levels that we've seen prior to the crisis is not sustainable, and it's got to go up, unfortunately. And here is where I think what we need to think about is, even if price go up, let's think about who should be charged more as well. You know, should the new members be penalised, you know, for past members' results? Should the young members be penalised versus the older members? You know, there's real questions about that. And, you know, the other thing is around discounts or loadings for the appropriate risk. So should white collars, you know, professionals deserve that 20% or 15% discount, you know, because they're looking very stressed at the moment. And, you know, I think we're all pretty stressed here. So I think even around charging more, it's about who to charge that to, you know, who to send that bill. And again, happy to debate that. But in seriousness, if we do nothing, if we really do nothing, then, you know, as indicated here, that elephant could do something really bad in that room, which nobody would appreciate. So if we do nothing, that's going to be a really bad, bad scenario. But if we do something, so coming back to what's happened in the workers' comp space a couple of years back, when the government did limit the amount of remuneration the lawyers can get, and, you know, there's been an improvement in terms of the claims. Now, that's one example. I'm sure some of the other items that we've discussed today, other benefit changes, can do far more. But we are ultimately optimistic people, and, you know, we can't keep thinking about the bad side of things, and it's also about opening new doors. And I'd like to come back to the GFC analogy again. So what happened at the GFC? So it was low doc loans, and now what's happened to the group insurance space? It's, you know, no doc insurance effectively. So on the GFC side, what's happened when, you know, these low doc loans have made major losses? Well, yields gone up. They just stopped lending. So people just stopped lending. Now, that's not an option in Australia with group insurance. We just can't stop providing cover. Now, arguably, the reinsurers might be able to, but I think the world needs to go on. You know, life insurers need to be able to find an avenue for risk transfer, just because, you know, the local reinsurance market's got a capacity strength. The music can't stop. We need to provide these covers. So one of the new doors that we suggest that could be opened up is to introduce new capacity into the local market. Music can't stop. You know, business needs to continue. Coverage needs to be provided. So now what the offshore reinsurers could potentially do is just, you know, look at the current market and provide capacity. And APRA would like me to say this, is if it's something that you like, they will potentially open up a branch. But that's, APRA would like me to say that. And then, you know, the other new doors that we can explore is, what if the premium's gone too far? What if it's increased too much? Let's try to bring back this profit sharing, you know, where something can be returned back to the members, and understand there's some administration constraints here for the funds. So then what about, you know, just like an operational risk reserve, you set up a smoothing or a claim equalisation reserve to put something behind for the rainy days. But I think we should start to think about this new door opening up, the profit sharing. Again, thanks very much for your attention here, and I hope I've put a lot of questions in you, you know, and hopefully you can ask me, or, you know, and ask Andrea. I'd be very happy to open up the discussion here. Thanks.
Thank you much, Andrea and Jan. It's your turn, everybody. Can I ask you to come up to one of the microphones? Can the first thing you say be your name? I always love it when these things say, before you start talking, give your name, which a lot of people find very difficult. So can the first thing you say be give your name? Thank you. Everyone else is thinking about it slowly. Do form a queue, because we don't want to waste time while people are coming up to the microphone. Naomi.
Thank you very much for that really interesting talk. I think that my super fund is probably the one on the graph that had the 140% premium increase. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to add to your list of things that drive that. You mentioned the stress and and that kind of issue. The other thing is the underlying true unemployment rate. And I think the experience we've got in Tasmania, where underlying non-workforce participation is now up to about 1 in 3 families are completely unemployed. We can very much look at government policy around levers to do with benefits, you know, being reduced, and I think we're in for a big tranche now, and we can track the spike that's happening through our fund. And so we're now in the position where, although you said, you know, of course we always will have to provide group life insurance, for the lower paid Australians, what's happening in some of the industry funds is that the premiums are becoming so large, we actually conscientiously have to ask ourselves the question whether we should be providing insurance to our premiums, because it's having such a massive deleterious effect on their retirement savings. So I think for the industry funds who work in that area, this is not just an elephant, it's kind of the Titanic has come into us and we're having to ask really big questions about what we should do here. So I guess it's sort of a warning for other states, but also a question as to what do we do as a trustee when we're facing this situation?
I guess there wasn't really a question there, but thanks for those. I agree thoroughly with the points that you've made, and certainly the situation that each client is in, whether it's a superannuation fund or an employer, there are quite different issues at play. Of course, for a trustee, where the members are paying, they have that obligation of balancing the adequacy and the affordability of the benefits, and where we've seen, because of all the competitions and premium rates dropping over recent years, many funds have taken the opportunity to increase the benefits, but looking at adequacy at the time, it was, and the affordability was fine, but it is definitely a serious concern that if you leave those sums insured the same with the same benefits, that the premiums really aren't affordable anymore for some members.
Bridget Brown. This is a more of a side issue, I suppose, but it does interest me. It was actually pointed out to me a couple of years ago. You know, we hear a lot about lost super, and someone who knew what they were talking about raised the issue not so much of underinsurance but overinsurance, because a lot of people who leave their employer continue to have group insurance schemes, premiums deducted from their sort of dormant balance. So to what extent are the claims being made on multiple schemes from one individual sort of going back and realising that they were employed here and they were employed there and they were employed somewhere else and ending up with 4 or 5 claims? And to what extent does the industry, coming back to Anthony's point about data, understand when it's a single individual making multiple claims?
Well, I don't actually have access to the data to answer that question, and if somebody else does have some information, then please let us know. But certainly my understanding is that the fact that we are now seeing claims coming through for people who really hadn't got that an awareness of the benefits that existed, there certainly must be a risk of multiple claims in different funds for that same person. And what I believe has certainly been priced into premiums in the past is that apathy that people had cover, were paying premiums but never knew that they had the cover, and therefore it wasn't expected they should claim, which certainly isn't an ideal situation for the individual. So certainly the risk both ways, that you have too much cover, and at the end of the day that's not in the interest of the member to be paying such high premium rates multiple times.
Yeah, and I mean that's a really interesting point. We did have a look at that, and often when we run tenders, our markets or our partners ask that question, and without reasonable access to reliable data, I think what we can safely assume that it is happening. You know, so on average, I think there were statistics around on average, Aussies might have 2 to 3 accounts, and in each account they would have that default amount. What does that mean? So for the data that you do have something very similar to that. So you've got a lot of members who's taken out default plus voluntary. So meaning if you look at the problems and take a step back, you go, well, it's the same thing. If you give people double amount of cover, they're going to claim more potentially, or they're going to might be incentivized to claim more. And I think that's probably where to start to have a look at where, in particular with some funds of giving the windows. Now, these members that's got those windows, look at them and look at those experiences. When you give people, say, default of 50K, they're going to go, I'm stressed, but not that stressed. But if you do give them 100K or 150K, they're going to start thinking about it. So I'd encourage you to start looking at the... You're probably already doing that. You know, look at those type of members and then try to potentially draw some conclusions on the fact that, on average, Aussies do have multiple amount of accounts at the moment.
Yep. Rob De Soysa. Touching on that point, do you think we really consider the needs of the members of the customer here? Because we seem to not have a needs-based level of cover. It's sort of, in some cases, it's too high. We have given a lot of bells and whistles in terms of high AALs, voluntary cover, which has significantly worse experience than the main level. We sort of set it at sort of theoretically sort of sound, but maybe overly high levels of cover rather than giving a basic. Do you think if we sort of move back to a more needs-based, lower levels as a sort of minimum level, should we call it, minimum level of protection to give something, then we'd be in a better place, and if people did need cover, then they'd go through an underwritten, a properly underwritten approach?
Definitely I agree. I mean, the fact that we have default cover, which... And basically what we've seen is over recent years that those default levels of death and TPD cover have been increasing dramatically because of the competition between funds. Of course, TPD is now a compulsory default benefit, whereas before MySuper it wasn't. One of the points that I made is it was really to make the question as to whether TPD is a benefit that's in the best interest of members, and really looking again, because it does look like such a high amount, if we place more focus on an income benefit, particularly in the early years when somebody first becomes injured, that will take away the incentive and I guess the attraction of the big benefit.
Yeah, and it's really interesting if you look at if you look at your retail books, TBD experience, look at your group insurance TBD experience, one looks really good actually, and I think part of that is already underwriting, because if you're going to be underwritten for something, you know you've got it. The other side of it is, I think on the retail space, not only there's underwriting, you can pick which definitions you might want to apply. So, you know, if you want to apply own occupation, it's expensive. It's any occupation is par, you get a discount for using the ADL. So I do think that there should be more potentially underwriting, or I mean again it comes back to that definition in the CIS Act, but the more you can do there, and to raise awareness there. I think you can see some of that nicer experience in the retail space. TPD only. Everything else is not good. Not as good. Well, labs and... But anyways.
Rod Berry. Look, thanks for that. A lot of good ideas presented. I'm just wondering, how many of these have you road tested with your trustee clients, and what would their appetite be to implement some of these changes?
So you're talking about a trustee?
Insurers would like to put a lot of these things through. How willing are the trustees?
I think it depends. So, I mean, we've had experience with some trustees who... are more willing to make the changes than others, and it'll depend on many different factors. But we've worked with a few clients where the TPD definitions have been changed, and some of them have been very very small changes. So as I mentioned, one of the things is to introduce a retraining aspect to the definition, and. One of the most important things for a trustee or an employer, whoever the client is to be able to get that information to understand what their options are and what the impact is likely to be. Now, obviously, it's early days, and sometimes it's quite difficult for an insurer to cost those changes. But I would certainly encourage insurers to be considering those options and to be basically creating that awareness and education for clients, because I think the more that we can educate them and to teach clients to understand what the impacts will be, particularly of the sustainability of the price and the terms and conditions over the longer term, then there's going to be more acceptance of them. And, of course, as we have more clients actually doing that, then I think it will be more generally accepted.
And you just to please still think about the questions you might want to ask. That was the 5-minute warning. So I will ask a question which could be answered from the floor as well as from the stage. Who do you think is best placed to fix this? Is it trustees, the insurers, the tender managers, the reinsurance brokers?
Well, I believe everybody's got a part to play, and one of the things that Aon is doing is trying to create that education, particularly amongst clients, and to work with insurers to understand what those options are.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, whoever it is, it can't be a singular person. I don't think it needs to be a collective, and it has to be on the right side of it altogether. I don't think it's any one particular person, group. Yeah.
Murray Glaze. Firstly, just an observation on a comment from Yan Sung. You suggested that extra capacity from outside the Australian market might be a solution. My opinion there would be that that's possibly just papering over a symptom until the business is fundamentally sustainable. You're not going to get capacity from either overseas or locally. But my question is, historically, particularly for industry funds, pricing has been based on the fundamental assumption of stability. And what we've seen in the past will be repeated in the future. During the decade of the noughties, we saw claims rates falling, and we thought that was wonderful. Everything was very profitable. It actually turned out claims rates weren't falling, they were just being deferred. I wonder if pricing actually needs to get far more sophisticated so that we correct that basic ignorance of what's really going on inside the funds. Do we need to understand more of what the clients are doing, what individual members are doing, what their particular circumstances are, what their occupation, age and other characteristics are?
Thanks for that valid point about offshore reinsurers won't commit capacity if things don't change. I'm absolutely in agreement. I think most of them are in that camp where they kind of say, well, benefit designs need to be changed here. You know, for example, a lot of them are in favour of things like, you know, everybody's got GSC, and then that'll allow the TPD to be slightly more buffeted. Things like that. I mean, they do want to see TPD definition from unlikely to enable. They do want to see that. And but what I think what I was referring to is during that transition phase, we still need the capacity in the market. We still need to be able to, you know, do that risk transfer. So they will do the interim bridging, and they can be sustainable going forward, because going forward, what they want is those changes to come through as well. Yeah. On the so that question, the other one was, oh yeah, so the question around, I think what you mentioned about, do we need to get more sophisticated in pricing? Happy to open up that can to the question to everybody else, but I think that still needs to come down to Anthony's point, was data. I mean, corporates might have some more better access to data, or readily updating and changing data, whereas industry funds, I think, have a little bit more hurdle there. And I think it does come down to data. So if you've got the data, if you've got the experience now, which is coming through, as you say, the deferred, which is all coming through, we can get more sophisticated in modelling. Things like stochastic modelling would be something that actuaries would love to do.
Possibly the real answer is that until we get it done, we won't have stability. So it's not a case of saying, well, it can't be done, so we'll just have to live with it. We have to fix this problem.
Yeah. We need to find a way to have that data. Yeah. Doing.
We're about to run out of time. Phil's been standing there very patiently.
Yep. No, you're right.
Please make a short question or point.
Talk about what the solution is. I think certainly one aspect that hasn't been discussed.
Sorry, Phil, could you say who you are?
Oh, sorry, Phil Stock, yeah. You just said who I was.
There are lots of Phils.
Filled with Phil. The one solution which needs to be aired is hopefully the introduction of risk-based capital through LAGIC will actually help solve the problem. Because if you look at it, just taking a step back, all of these problems that we've discussed were predictable to a certain extent in advance, because what we were doing was we were taking risks which we were basically not pricing for. So, for example, we were putting in automatic acceptance limits which were way too high and not pricing for that because nobody else was pricing. You know, we were, you know, it's easy to be wise after, you know, I mean, it's pretty obvious what we were doing. And if we actually, and maybe the regulators need to take some lead in this, but if we actually started acknowledging these risks and saying, if we take these risks, we are going to have to hold extra capital for them, and that then provides probably a reasonable basis in a free market for actually deciding whether we're actually going to offer these freebies to the clients, if it actually is going to cost us something to do that. I mean, a big one, another similar one, is the data issue. You know, the poor quality of data that insurers have been collecting, on which they've been basing pricing, is actually quite amazing to me, to someone who's sort of come fairly late in my career into this area. But I mean, again, it's a disaster waiting to happen. And if we actually started making proper allowance for operational risk, and, you know, not realising that the, yeah, but you know what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, agree.
A one-sentence answer, response?
I think somebody start listening to or thinking about the 1 in 250, meaning how much can I lose in 1 in 250 event. I think a lot of this might have been avoided or minimised.
Right, please give your feedback on the FSF app and thank me. Thank with me.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank Jan and Andrew.
Thanks very much, Paul.